So, further talk this evening, having just arrived at the airport this afternoon, and after a 24-hour flight, roughly, I don't know, something like that, felt like that anyway, I should be jet-lagged. I should be exhausted. But I refuse to get exhausted, I refuse to have jet lag, because it's something about the power of the mind. I think the last time I gave a talk, 2 weeks ago, I gave a talk about Buddhism health, and it's incredible just how your mind has power. That talk 2 weeks ago, if I remember correctly, I did mention that the first year I was in Thailand as a monk, so many of the monks were getting ill, especially problems with their digestion, because the food was not really hygienic, it was really dirty. And I think I gave you an example. Sometimes the monk, the lay people would actually, is one of the monks, one of the people here who was with me at that time, sometimes the lay people in these villages would put food in your bowl. But before they put food in the bowl, especially the cold season, because they had runny nose, they would, and then put food in your bowl. So it wasn't the case that people would even wash their hands, first of all. I don't think they even had soap. But anyway, maybe they did, but they weren't that sort of hygienic. So every now and again you got some diarrhea. And I remember that 1 year that all these monks were getting diarrhea, and this is a pain in the butt. So I decided I'm not going to get diarrhea. And I told all the other monks, I said, this year I'm going to be healthy, I'm not going to get diarrhea. And it worked. It's weird. Just because I said I'm not going to get it, it never happened. It just showed something about the power of the mind. And so I can actually teach these things, and oh, they really actually work. So, going over there, it doesn't matter, get jet lag or whatever. I'm not going to get jet lag. I'm not going to fall asleep this evening until maybe afterwards. But the topic of the talk, one of the talks which I gave on that trip, and I thought it's a nice one to weave a talk around. This was at the Buddhist Society in London, the oldest Buddhist society over in London. And I went there when I was a young man trying to find a place to do my Buddhism, and they really helped me. And I'm sure everyone has this wonderful sense of gratitude. If someone's really helped you, if this is where you've grown up, if this is the sort of things you really want to do, and they helped you, of course you want to help them back. It's just gratitude. And it's wonderful being able to sort of have that bit of payback. So I really enjoyed going to the Buddhist Society of London and many other places where I could give something back. And the talk I gave at that Buddhist Society in London was The Meaning of Life. So that's basically the talk this evening, The Meaning of Life. And on the same subject, they also went over up to Cambridge, and the University Buddhist Society there, which was also an important part of my life, actually a really crucial part of my life. That's where I really got into this practice of meditation and Buddhism. Without that, I wouldn't be here today. And so I went to give a talk there. And it's just a bit of nostalgia, because the place where I gave the talk for the Cambridge University Buddhist Society, it had some history for me. Because that was the first place I went on TV. And I'll tell you why. Because this was the 60s and 70s. I think this happened in 1970 or 71 it could have been. All the other universities in UK at the time, and even in France, I think even in Australia, they all had demonstrations, students demonstrating about something or other. And I'd been in that university for 2 years. We hadn't had any demonstration at all. And I felt my university career was passing away, and I was missing something important, an essential part of the student experience, demonstrating against something. And so once there was a demonstration, and to this day I can't remember exactly what it was, and it didn't matter anyway. I didn't know what I was demonstrating against, I was just demonstrating. Honestly, it's true. And so there demonstrating, we had to have our big meeting, and it was in that building where I gave my talk a week ago. in the same Lady Mitchell Hall in the Sidgwick site. Anyone knows that area? And in those days, I had much more hair than I have now. In those days, I had a beard as well. In those days, I had just really daggy clothes. Well, it's a bit daggy, but I need a wash. I've been on the road for a long time. But these were really daggy clothes, jeans. I was ahead of my time in fashion. My jeans had holes in, but they were just natural holes, not these manufactured holes which ladies wear these days. But the point was, I looked the part. The BBC were outside with their cameras filming the demonstration in Cambridge, and I looked like a student should look, you know, for the TV. No makeup, it was natural. So as we were walking in, I did see the cameras rolling, so I was the one who was filmed, who got on the 6 o'clock news. And I knew that because the following day I caught hell from my parents and my relations and friends. You should be studying. You shouldn't be wasting your education, that great opportunity, you know, by taking the day off to have a demonstration. I was like, why me? There's about 400 other students there. Why did you pick on me? Because I was the one in front of the camera as I was going in. So I don't know. But anyway, it shows that even then I was telegenic. But anyway, coming back to the talk, the meaning of life, something a bit more serious. First of all, the greatest definition of life I have ever come across in one sentence, because people are very busy, don't remember very much except the jokes. The meaning of life. Life is a sexually transmitted terminal disease. And, you know, it's a one line, but there's actually a lot of truth to that. But it's a bit nihilistic. It doesn't really say much about what life is or what you're supposed to do about it since, I don't know, from the time you're born until the time you do terminate. But this is why the people in their life, they look for some sort of meaning, something to do, something to give this life much more than just, you know, sexually transmitted terminal disease, just waiting for your death. There must be something more to do in the meantime. And of course, that is what we call the meaning of life. Now, one of the first things which I understood, you know, when I started contemplating these things, that the meaning of life is not out there waiting for you to discover it. It's not some sort of hidden wisdom which, you know, if you get the enlightenment, the great sort of meditations, it all comes, now I know the meaning of life. Oh, at that talk I did actually mention one thing, that I have now been a monk 42 years. I had to tell them that in my bio. And it is an important year for a monk, 42, because that number is the answer to the meaning of life. For those of you who've read Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, number 42 was the answer they were looking for. But that's just joking about. But the important thing is, the meaning of life is not really out there waiting for you to sort of discover and embrace it. The meaning of life is the meaning you give to your life. Now that makes it much more important, because it's not some passive thing which you ask somebody else. Please, Ajahn Brahm, tell me the meaning of my life. Please, great master, please elucidate why we are here. The why you are here is what reason, purpose you give to this life. Now once you get past the meaning of life is something outside of you, something metaphysical, something you've got to discover, and instead say it's what you're going to give to your life, now you can understand much more about the role of karma, what you're doing, actions, kindness, generosity, and how that is how you give your life meaning. It's not that just, you're a doctor, it's what you put into being a doctor. It's not just you're a mother, it's how you're a mother. It's not even just you're a monk, it's how you're a monk. The meaning you put in to what you're doing. Now, once you get that message, you know, in your heads, now you understand why people keep searching for the meaning of life instead of giving meaning to their life. And when you're searching, sometimes you get very depressed, sometimes you get very confused. Look, stop and give your life some meaning. For me, when I was a young student, going back to those student times, I started thinking, I've got all this time in front of me, my life, now my life is ebbing away, I'm getting old. But you can always give life some meaning, every time. It doesn't have to be one meaning, many meanings of your life. So for me, it was always about a balance between service and giving. So service and solitude. What I can give for others, and just the joy and happiness for myself. Any job which I had to do, I always had to make sure it was going to be my own fulfillment. That was important. You can't just separate yourself out from other people and think you don't count, but also to be able to serve and help other people. That was so important for me. To me, that was a good understanding, an essence of what the meaning of life should really be. Serving others, making a difference, whichever way you can, in even small ways, in just one way. For example, again, on the first time I went as a monk to UK, I was taken up to this idyllic place in the northwest of Scotland, Oban. Is any Scots people here? Oban. It's a beautiful fishing village on the northwest coast. And it was the summertime, it was beautiful then. If it was the wintertime, it would be the most miserable place on earth. That's the other weird thing about just recently coming back. I never saw any rain in England the last 2 weeks. I was wondering if I was in that right country or whether I'd landed in the wrong place. London, without any drizzle, was weird. But anyway, this beautiful town of Oban, that's where we were teaching a retreat. And I was only a tiny monk, a baby monk at that time. So this other senior monk was a teacher. And I was his attendant, basically just hanging out, making sure that whatever he needed, he got. When I travel, I don't go with attendants anymore. Actually, I do go with attendants. When I went to London, I had about 8 or 9 attendants. They're called flight attendants. And they looked after me very well. So why do you need to travel with them? And when I got to the other end, I had all sorts of other attendants looking after me, giving me bangers and mash. You know, that's an English food. Bangers and mash. It's nothing to do with terrorists. Bangers does not mean explosive devices. It means sausages and mash, as I used to have as a kid. But anyway, back when I was, don't need to have any attendants, but I was the attendant of this monk. And you know, being an attendant like Venerable Kasapa here is to me, sometimes all he does is sit there, doesn't say anything. And sometimes it can be very boring. He's meditating, he's a good meditator, that's fine. But you know, when I'm going to go off on a tangent. True story, when I first came to Perth, 33 years ago, there was another monk, I'd called Ajahn Jacaro. Some of you remember him. He did all the talks. I was his attendant. So I was really good at being an attendant. I just sat there quietly meditating, never said a word. And you know what happened after about 6 months? That monk, Ajahn Jacaro, he went to Thailand. A bit of R&R and also to catch up with Ajahn Chah, who was still alive. Oh no, so yeah, he's still alive at that time. So I had to give the talk. And the first time I gave a talk, this young kid came up, maybe about 11 or 12, and he said, "That was amazing. You can talk." I thought you were mentally disabled. Thank you. So Venerable Kasapa is not mentally disabled. He's not even laughing. That's good meditation. Not even a smile. Got a smile from him? Come on. No. Yes! I broke through his samadhi. Terrible monk. Sorry, Venerable. But anyway, so I was the attendant. And all these people would come in, and you know, say the same old questions, and the monk would answer them. But then I was getting bored, and then this woman came in, maybe about 30s or 40s, and she came straight into this room and said, "I've come to thank you for saving my life." And the way she said it was, wow, that really pushed me back, the force and sincerity of what she said. You mean a monk has saved your life? You know, he's not a doctor, he hasn't been in an emergency room and kept your heart going when you've had a cardiac arrest. What on earth has this monk done? And that's when she told her story. Her story was, again, as a student, she had depression, anxiety, like young people, it's really tough. You know, managing your schooling, trying to get good marks so you can get a good career, your social life, girls and boys, your parents, you know, your finances, it's really, really tough. I remember that. It's really a tough time in your teenage years. And some people have that resilience because they went to talks like Chris Perry's in a couple of weeks' time. They got resilience. But some people you don't have that. A few real difficulties, a few bits of bad luck, and you really sort of go under the water. Depression, anxiety, and all sorts of stuff. And so they do have psychologists, psychiatrists in those days, but, you know, fortunately it's gone a lot better since those days. Anyone who had a little bit of depression was given Valium. It was apparently in those days, this is what they said, given away like sweets to any student. So she got addicted to Valium. And for years. And this is, I remember her telling the story. It's just, some of these memories are really, really sharp because they really affected me. I really woke up, wow, what's going on here? And she said that she was given Valium as a maybe a 19-year-old, was addicted. But when she came on this meditation course, she was actually on the retreat the year before. She heard something like, you've got to keep your precepts, Buddhist precepts, on the retreat. And one of those precepts is no alcohol or drugs. Now that means no non-medicinal drugs. You know, if you're being given insulin or some medication, please take it if you're going on a retreat. But it wasn't explained that well. She thought, no drugs. Oh my goodness, that means I can't take my Valium. And she thought, well, what am I going to do? So she gave it a try. Now remember, this was an idyllic, calm, peaceful fishing village on the northwest coast of Scotland, you know, 40 years ago. Beautiful, summertime. People were meditating. There was no stress at all in that place. Everything was organized, peaceful. People weren't forcing you to get up early or forcing you to meditate or forcing you anything. You had no pressure on you at all. So she could do that without going crazy. It's a bit of a miracle. And the point was that after 9 days of that, she thought, wow, I've given up this drug for 9 days. Maybe I can go for a few more days. And then she told me that it's very easy going without that when you're in Oban fishing village with really kind, good people, just with a nice little schedule, everything is peaceful and no stress. But then she had to go back home. And the only way to go back home would be via Glasgow railway station. Now, I just was a couple of days ago in Victoria railway station and King's Cross. I know at King's Cross station, any Harry Potter fans here, you know what they've done in King's Cross station in London? They've made a platform, was it 13 and a half, was it? 9 and a half, or whatever, something and a half. They made platform 8 and a half, or whatever, and they've got like a luggage trolley halfway through the wall. And you can actually, you queue up, and they give you like a scarf of his school. Oh, that was Hogwarts, wasn't it? Hogwarts school, got that one right, good. They give you a scarf, and you can get your photograph taken going into platform, what, and a half. I thought it was really cool. You know, a bit of sort of tourism there, but sort of why not? And anyway, I never got my photograph taken there because they didn't have any money. And I don't need to go to Hogwarts. I've got my own magic powers. Anyway, back to going through all this. I mean, they're really, even for myself, a monk, they're really, really stressful. Thousands of people going in all directions. And if, you know, you don't sort of look out carefully, you get hit by a trolley. So anyway, there she had to go through Glasgow Station. And she actually made it just. She said, it was just really touch and go many times, just totally breaking apart. And she said, what kept her going was the teachings, which she heard, just let it go. This too will pass. You know that story of the ring, Emperor's ring, this too will pass. So just hang in there, it's not going to get worse, don't be afraid. It will just disappear after a while, it will get better. Little things like open the door of your heart so you don't add any extra mental resistance to what you're experiencing. All those sorts of teachings, and many more which you've heard here and many other places, that just kept her together, just. So she'd get on a train and get back home, where she said she spent about a month sitting in a chair, she said. That's all she could do. But little by little, a month of sitting in a chair, totally unable to do anything, little by little the effect of that drug wore off. And she said it was, I'm using her words. It was like being in a mist, being in the fog, and not realizing it because she got used to that. And now that fog had lifted and she was alive again. Food tasted delicious. She could experience and really enjoy the sunsets. She could see a tree in bloom in the springtime. Everything became alive again for her. So that's why she came and said, thank you for saving my life. It was totally unexpected. There was misunderstanding the precepts, but the other teachings which had kept her together for that time, that was really important to her. You know, when I heard that, I thought, wow, that's the meaning, not the meaning of my life, but that's the meaning I'm going to put into my life. I'm going to see if I can do some teaching, some service. And I thought that that particular meaning I'm putting into my life will be fulfilled once one person comes up to me and says, Ajahn Brahm, thank you for saving my life. And of course, I'm not exaggerating when it's probably at least 1,000 now people have said that. I don't know how many people in the last 2 weeks in England came up to me and said, and they said, I know you've heard this before, but thank you for saving my life. And they meant it. These teachings are really, really powerful. And people show so much gratitude for all these teachings. And when I had, when that little trip over in UK, one of the greatest signs of gratitude which I've ever seen, and I never ever expected to see this in my lifetime, that somebody, I helped her so much, she's about, I don't know, 30-year-old, 35-year-old, she showed me, she exposed her upper arm. And there on her upper arm is a big tattoo of Ajahn Brahm. That was really weird, I'd never seen that before. I mean, that's a tattoo, you can't take it off, you can't rub it off, and it actually looked like me as well. Really cool. So she's got a tattoo of Ajahn Brahm on her arm. And I was telling the peasant, I have to report everything. I said, I'm glad she's got it on her arm and not on some of the other places on her body, because that would be really embarrassing. No, tattoos are just how people do things these days. But you know, that's how she showed her respect, you know, for helping her, and saving her life and stuff. So that was crazy to see that. But anyway, that became one of the meanings of my life, to help somebody. Now, if you give a meaning to your life, you actually put the meaning in there, you can imagine just what comes up when you achieve that meaning. The amount of happiness and fulfillment. But there's no way that I can ever get depressed. No way. Because you've set a meaning, a good one, and you get this incredible stuff back. I just need to think about that, and I don't get depressed, I cry. Sometimes I love doing things like that, crying. I'm a man, I'm a monk, I cry. Every time you really, really do something amazing for somebody else, or for our Buddhist society, or for that time we did, you all know these stories, but here we go. That time when we did the 30th anniversary of our Buddhist society, actually it's coming up to our 50th soon, isn't it? Must be soon.
30th anniversary of the Buddhist Society of West Australia, we held this big event in Supreme Court Gardens, you know, when Supreme Court Gardens existed and it wasn't turned into some big water park. Actually, no, it hasn't. Actually. They still kept Supreme Court Gardens, haven't they? They got Queen Elizabeth Quay or something, but Supreme Court Gardens, is it still there?
Yeah.
That's good, because that's historic. It's heritage, because of what happened with the Buddhist Society of West Australia. Big occasion. We decided, yeah, let's give it everything we've got. Put lots of money in there, and I think many of you know what happened there. Rain. Storm. Big storm. You know, where they have these, what's it called these days? They have like storm alerts. Storm alert issued that day. Premier's office called me 3 times. Are you cancelling? No. Monks came up and said, Ajahn Brahm, you've got to cancel. You're embarrassing us. No. So we held it, and the rain stopped. Just for our ceremony. Those of you who don't believe in miracles, that was a real dinky-die, 100% full-on miracle. Shouldn't have stopped. Left to the east, west, north, south of Supreme Court Gardens, trees were coming down. Lots of people never came. And they couldn't believe we held a ceremony. I said, what, we held a ceremony? That's impossible. It was a storm. And that was actually hit Perth at that particular time. And even the, I always remember this, I think I still got the email somewhere, that the firm, I don't mind sort of giving them a plug, Rees Hire, who hired us all the tents and the marquees and the electric work, the PA systems, and you know, the whole sort of event hire. They wrote this email back afterwards. What, you held the event? I said, yeah. And they said, we never heard of that Ajahn Brahm before, but can you please ask him who's going to win the horse racing this week? Yes, yes, that's my man. They thought, well, you could stop the rain, you could tell us who's going to win the horses. So, but that was, you know, to me, you know, you've seen me, I don't just let other people do the work, I do it myself as well, really get in there. And so, you know, packing up afterwards, didn't finish till maybe 12, 1 o'clock in the morning. And the following morning I had to go off to Melbourne, because I had many, many jobs. I'm also the spiritual advisor of the Buddhist Society of Victoria, so I had to go and do their ceremonies for them. That was the first time I got checked in at the airport, domestic terminal, flying Qantas over to Melbourne to carry on more work. As soon as I checked in, sat in the corner of the, you know, the big airport now, it hasn't changed, that's the way it was then, and cried my eyes out. You've done something, you achieved something. Something which was impossible. This incredible ceremony to show, just give so much, really give, and you get this wonderful meaning back. Other beings help you if you help them. You know why? I'm just going to go off into another story I haven't told here before, but I was telling this a lot in England. You know, the reason I went over to UK, you know I'm very, very involved in actually giving equity to women in Buddhism. You know, you've seen that as most Buddhist centers you ever go to, you see men giving talks, monks. Tibetan monks, very few Tibetan nuns. This is actually quite exceptional that here in Perth we've got this great nuns monastery at Dhammasara. You don't have monasteries like that elsewhere. So really make sure that women have the opportunity to be ordained. Really giving it. So what we've been doing, we've been setting up a funds to get some monastery over in England, just for bhikkhunis. There's plenty of monks' monasteries over there for nuns. So what's actually happened was that it's a tough thing to do. Just like setting up the nuns' monastery here, or setting up even this place. Years and years ago, there's only a few of us. But there's a simile of the quail. A quail is a very small bird. And in this story, there was a forest fire, a bushfire. And all the birds who could fly were flying away. All the animals who could run were running away. But this little bird, a quail is the tiniest of birds, saw that there were many birds who yet
had learned how to fly who couldn't fly. And many little animals who could only crawl, they couldn't outrun a forest fire. And this little quail felt such compassion for all these animals who would be burnt, who would die because they couldn't outrun the fire. So this little quail did an impossible thing. She decided, well, you've got to do something. So this little quail just flew to the nearest pond, dived into the water to make sure all her wings and feathers were wet, and then flew over the fire and flapped her little wings so a few drops would fall over the fire. And then went back again and did it again, back again, did it again. If you were an engineer, you'd realize there was not enough water even probably before it hit the ground. It would evaporate. But that was not an engineer, that was someone who was so compassionate and kind. At least she was doing something, even though it was impossible. And according to the story, which is one of my favorites, she kept going again and again, doing an impossible, totally irrational. But at least she was doing something. Then all these other beings in all the other realms of existence, they saw this quail. Wow, this is one hell of a quail. That, you know, she's sacrificing herself, doing the impossible. We'd better come to her assistance. So all the other little heavenly beings started helping out, eventually making this huge rainstorm which extinguished the fire. Just because of this little bird had such inspiration. I'm just going to do it, even though it's impossible. I'm going to start. Maybe other people will come and give me a hand afterwards. And that is a lot of my meaning of life. Anything which I have done, giving meaning. Oh, it's impossible. Can't be done. No way. Yes? Well, I'm going to try. I'm going to start. See what happens afterwards. For any of you who are a bit afraid of the future of this planet with climate change, always remember that simile of the quail. A couple of people just starting, just giving a try. Impossible. Can't be done. You try. You give it a go. You start. And other people will come and give you a hand. That is the nature of this world. So whatever meaning you give in this life, never ever follow your head. Because too often, okay, I'm a theoretical physicist. You can't get more in your head than that. And just while I was over there, the people who remember Bernard, Professor Bernard Carr, who came for our GCB, we had a nice lunch with him, with some friends. He came to my talk in Cambridge in that hall where I was first photographed as a student agitator. And in between, he did actually go and see Stephen Hawking. He had some project with him. So, you know, that Bernard, he is a close friend of Stephen Hawking. Stephen Hawking came to his marriage. And he's actually in the film, The Theory of Everything. And he even got a gig to go to the premiere in London because he was a close friend of Stephen Hawking. But anyway, so I'm in my head, okay? At least I started off like that. Then moved it down into the heart. But into the head, only a few things are possible in this world. In your heart, almost everything is. This is part of the great thing about Buddhism and knowing the power of the mind and the heart. The head only allows a few things to happen. The heart has no boundaries at all. What you can achieve, how you can change things, how you can make things happen, which should not happen at all. So that's what I was doing over there. I know that's going to happen. We're going to get a nice monastery for women in England. Bhikkhunis, fully ordained, fully funded, looked after. It's impossible. My head says, my heart says something different. Even this evening, my head said I should be exhausted now, travelling all that way, jet-lagged. But my heart says, no, let's try something else. Please, the meaning of the life does not live in your head. Don't think about it, feel it, be inspired, and do something which is impossible, which is really giving your life meaning. Don't ever say, I can't do this, I can't achieve this, it can't be done. Who said it can't be done? Do it. See what happens. So many people, look, even health. Really, I tend to get stuck with a lot of people who are dying of cancer and stuck with them. Yeah, I've got to get rid of them. But I like to get rid of them, keeping them alive. Can't be done. Who said?
Believe your heart, not your head. That is where amazing stuff happens. That's where there is no limitations. And it gives life a far greater meaning. You know, a lot of times we've lost the meaning of life. Life is just, oh, we're going to die anyway. Oh, the world is a mess. Oh, Donald Trump might win the election. Just the economy is going down. For goodness sake, just know you can give whatever meaning you want to this life. Negative, reinforcing other people's sort of bad ideas, saying, oh, it's a dog-eat-dog world. It's not a dog-eat-dog world. I've never seen a dog eat a dog. I've seen them eat sort of dog food. I've seen them eat bones. Never seen a dog eat a dog. It's not a dog-eat-dog world. So, but people get so negative, and that's the reason why that people just lose any meaning to their life. So, here you go. Doesn't matter how old you are. What meaning have you want to give to your life today? There's so much stuff which you can do. And when you do give your life meaning, something which is really important, not just fame and winning the lottery. Oh, that's a crazy thing. That's not meaning. That's being mean. It hasn't got the ing on the end. Just for me. Because it's not, life is not just about you. It's not just about others. I've told this too many times already. What is life about? It's all about us. Okay, here we go. So if you haven't heard this before, marriages, and Dennis is over here somewhere. He's here early. I was over there. He knows I always do this same story. We do marriages together because he does the official part because of my rules, I'm not allowed to actually sign the form. And I do the fun part, you know, sprinkle with holy water, getting really wet. I love that one. I make marriages memorable. Soaking. But I always tell the story, look at the bride. Now you're a married woman, you must not think of yourself. Look at the husband. Now you're a married man, you must not think of yourself. Look, still looking at the man, the groom. Now you're a married man, you mustn't think of your wife. Look at the wife. Now you're a married woman, you mustn't think of your husband. In a marriage, you should not think of yourself, nor should you think of your partner. And the answer is, oh, come on, I said this so many times, you must know the answer. The answer is, in a marriage, in any relationship, never think of yourself, never think of others. Never think of others, okay? Never think of yourself, always think of us. Please include yourself in a marriage, in a relationship, in a Buddhist society. This community here, it's not about me, it's not about you, it's always about us. We're all involved in this. So when it's all about us, now you get an understanding of what meaning is. We're in it together. What affects you affects me. What affects me affects everybody. So when it's all about us, it's so easy to understand where that meaning of life can become. There is no difference between service to others and looking after yourself. Fulfillment to others, making this better world, and making yourself a better person. They both go together. You know, sometimes we have all these retreats and people think, well, what's the meaning of a retreat? Just sitting on your bum all day for 9 days, helping absolutely nobody. Who do you serve when you're just, you know, meditating by yourself in a beautiful retreat center? You're just not achieving anything, not contributing, you're just sucking up resources from others. Which actually you are. But that's not the point. If you can meditate, if you can be peaceful, you're actually helping others. Because all the people who have to put up with you, at least you're not around for 9 days. That's quite negative. But not that, but all the people you'll meet afterwards. Whatever peace, happiness, joy, wisdom, compassion, whatever it is you get on that retreat, which is huge, you'll automatically share with others afterwards. Sometimes we have in Buddhism sharing of merits. How does that work? It's natural. Whatever merits, good karma, kindness, peace, generosity, whatever it is you have generated over 9 days or even just this evening, that will be spread to everyone you'll meet on this weekend. You'll be a much more peaceful, wonderful person. Even in England, people were saying that their husband doesn't mind them coming off for a couple of days on a mini-retreat, because they know their husband, when they come back, their wife when they come back, is much nicer to them, doesn't complain too much. At the very least, when they're on one of my mini-retreats for 3 days, at least they're not spending from their credit card. That's being pretty mean and stereotyping, so I don't mean that. Please take that out of the transcript. But they're kinder, more peaceful, more wonderful people. That's why it's wonderful that they can come there. And that's what you share to other people. So whatever meaning you give to your life, your own life, personal life, automatically goes out to others. So sometimes you look in life, what do you really want to use your time for? Obviously for some people it's just surviving, getting by, or is it just surviving? Even though it's tough, still you're giving a lot of meaning to your life. Yes, you are not contributing and giving. You're like the person in medical school, you're learning. Learning your life, what it's all about. So that afterwards when you graduate from medical school, you can be a doctor and serve others. That's why being a monk, being a nun, sitting in the monastery, having nothing to do all day, yeah, that's nice if you can get away with it. But that's not how it works. For many, many years you don't contribute. But afterwards you certainly do. Big time. So that's why, like, why become a monk, why become a nun? We are doctors, specialists of the mind and the heart. Invest a few years, it's quite a lot of years, until you can actually know exactly what you're up to, what you're doing, but then, whoa, you're a great specialist, which can help a lot of people, give a lot of meaning into this world. So I don't think this life is ever meaningless. Yeah, if you become a sort of philosopher, theoretical physicist, yeah, you might think it's meaningless because you haven't developed the other part of you, the heart. Move that sort of attention down to your heart, the sort of intuitive part where the mind lives, and then, whoa, it's amazing the meaning you can give to your life. And at the end of your life, what will happen? All the people who come and say how much you meant to them, how much meaning you gave into their lives. You don't have to do much for that. Just a tiny bit of kindness, a tiny bit of just being there for one another, just a tiny bit of opening your heart, a tiny bit of like forgiveness, just to say to other people, look, you are more than beautiful enough. You are good enough. I care for you. I love you. You don't have to change. My father's meaning of his life was to give me that wonderful teaching. He got many parts of his meaning of life, but he gave me the teaching that opened the door of your heart. No matter who you are, no matter what you do, son, the door of my heart's always open to you. That's meaning. That's something which, wow, you share that with so many other people, and that just has huge effects on people. Traumatized people. That's actually mentioned briefly about one of these elderly women. Husband came the first day. She booked in for my mini-retreat, but she couldn't come because she was so painful. She never slept the night before, but she came the second day. That was the teaching more than anything else, which really overcame the pain. Not really overcame the pain, but made it sort of enabled her to be more than the pain, which has stopped her. The door of my heart always opened. So this is how we give meaning to our life. It's meaning is not out there. You see it, you give it, and then you make that meaning such that it creates a lot of happiness for yourself, a lot of happiness for this, for the world. And opens up possibilities which are literally boundless. What world do you want to make? Give it meaning. It can be done. Thank you for listening. Oh, come on. You can do much better than that. Sadhu.
Sadhu! Sadhu! That is better. Okay, there are some questions, comments, or complaints. Complaints are allowed. So, any questions? Because apparently it's not live streamed. Or is it live streamed? Because they got a new computer. There's always stuff coming, happening with that room in the back there. Any questions from the audience here? Now, does that mean you're not going to actually come in front here in a big line with your questions? Which you are anyway. Okay, so I'll finish off because I'm supposed to be jet-lagged. I don't know why I'm not. Even actually on the way out I wasn't jet-lagged. It's weird. A lot of times, you know, the mind is just so strong you can do anything, it seems. Even when I'm dead, after my cremation, I think I can still give a talk. Okay, let's pay respects to Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, and then you can come and line up with your questions.
Arahaṃ Sammā Sambuddho Bhagavā Buddhaṃ Bhagavantaṃ Abhivādhemi Suvākāto Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammaṃ Namassāmi Suppatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sanghaṃ Namāmi. Thank you.